Hello and welcome to Fixing Healthcare, our weekly podcast on American medicine. I'm Jeremy Corr, host of the Popular New Books in Medicine podcast and CEO of Executive Podcast Solutions. With me is Dr. Robert Pearl. For 18 years, Robert led the Permanente Medical Group, the nation's largest physician group. He's a healthcare contributor at Forbes.com, a best-selling author and professor at both the Stanford University School of Medicine and Business. His upcoming book, ChatGPT MD, How AI-Empowered Patients and Doctors Can Take Back Control of American Medicine, will be available on Amazon starting Tuesday, April 9th. All profits will be donated to Doctors Without Borders. Information on a range of medical topics can be found on his website, robertpearlmd.com, and on his monthly musings published the second Tuesday of each month. Our guest today is Stephen Petro. He's an award-winning journalist and book author who is best known for his New York Times and Washington Post essays on aging, health, and civility. In December 2023, he published an opinion piece in the New York Times entitled, "I Promised My Sister I Would Write About How She Chose to Die."
Good morning, Stephen, and welcome to Fixing Healthcare.
Thank you, Robert. Glad to be here.
As you know, this is our ninth season, and it's focused on end-of-life issues. At the end of December, you wrote a beautiful and moving article in the New York Times titled, "I Promised My Sister I Would Write About How She Chose to Die." Can you tell listeners about Julie and the rest of your family?
I'm the eldest of three siblings. Julie was our baby. We have about 5 years between us, and then we have a middle child, our brother Jay, and we were always a tight knit group. Julie characterized me as the troublemaker. She was the instigator, and my brother was the mediator, which was pretty much true, you know, entirely through our lives. And then even when she became ill with ovarian cancer, about 6 years ago, she was a lawyer. She was a financial executive. She was married to her wife, Maddie, for 35 years. They have two beautiful girls in their 20s, my nieces, two of my nieces. And Julie and Maddie lived in Maplewood, New Jersey. So that's, you know, that's a thumbnail there.
6 years ago, she became sick. What was her clinical course like, particularly in the early years before she had to confront death being so proximate?
Well, it's interesting. So she was diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer in November of 2017. And I'm a health journalist in real life when I'm not being a brother. And Julie was also a voracious researcher and reader. You know, so from the very beginning, we understood what the chances of long-term survival were, which were small. And over that period of time, over those years, she had what's called debulking surgery, which was about a 9-hour procedure. And if I remember correctly, they removed about every internal organ that you can without compromising, you know, patient's life. She had numerous rounds of chemo. She was in two experimental trials. She kind of ran through all of the options that were in her oncologist's black briefcase, or whatever we want to call that. But throughout, she was very focused on how to live. At the same time, she was preparing how to die. And I think it was in the end of year one or the beginning of year two, she and Maddie took an online course about death and dying, which helped them facilitate various conversations within our family about what that means, about not having this terrible fear of talking about that possibility. Julie really led us in so many conversations that no topic was really not to be spoken about. And you know, in our culture, especially, Robert, you know, death is terrifying, and we put people who are dying away, you know, whether they're in, you know, whether they're in a home, whether they're in hospice, whether they're in the hospital, they're not with us generally. And you go back 100 years, 120 years, people lived and died at home amongst their families. It was a way that really kind of helped everyone to see that death is a part of life. We've moved very much away from that model, but Julie wanted us to, you know, I can't say we were ever comfortable about it, but she wanted it to be something that we could talk about, not be afraid to talk about, and she certainly wasn't.
As I listened to you describe it and read your piece, I'm struck by how the time, on one hand, is so short. Everyone at the end of life wanted her to prolong it by another week or a month. They all had excuses for why she couldn't end it sooner. And yet, it was so long in terms of the suffering. How was that time experience as a loving brother? How'd you find it?
To be honest, I was kind of in this, trying to think of the right word. I was going to use the word bipolar, but not in a medical way, but just I was of two minds about living and dying. And so we were having this conversation about both living and dying, and I certainly did not want her to die. And when the early conversations started to take place about medical aid and dying, or what's also called MAID, M-A-I-D, I listened, but I heard like inside of me this dissonance, because that meant, well, it seemed like the worst nightmare possible. Yeah, she was going to decide, or she might decide, well, I'm going to end my life on a particular day at a particular hour. And that was so out of my experience, Robert. It was really kind of terrifying in a way. And I remember Julie explained to me, you know, when you're looking at births, many, many families will plan a cesarean, and it's going to take place on this day at that time, whatever that is. And, you know, and the family is generally present in some way. So that was, you know, that was part of reorientation of my views. But I also came to understand that by becoming a supporter and an advocate of her choice to exercise medical aid in dying, it did not mean that I wanted to see her die. They were really separate things, very separate things. And she was so empowered by having that choice that it resonated with me. I felt that, you know, she had always been a woman who was in charge. One of the favorite photographs we all have of her, she's on a boat, and she has, wasn't her boat, but she had taken over, and she was the pilot, and almost pirate, but that's who she was. And so she wanted this, she wanted that option. And then as we got towards the, you know, towards the last several months, when I saw really clearly how much she was suffering, and this was despite hospice nurses using the whole weaponry of pain meds, fentanyl and morphine and so on, they just weren't mitigating the pain. And, you know, at that point I was like, whatever she wants, whenever she wants, because no one should have to suffer like this.
At what point would you say she made this decision, and having made it, did she ever doubt her decision?
She stopped treatment in April of 2023, just about a year ago. And, you know, at that point, her oncologist said, when Julie asked him how much time she had, he said probably 2 to 3 months. He said most likely, because she already had liver metastases, that it would be both fairly soon and fairly painless, because the meds would sort of overtake her, and then her liver would fail. And that would be that. You know, unfortunately, that scenario didn't happen, and she continued. And so we got into the beginning of June, and I think she was very clearly looking at the calendar at that point. And then she was like, oh my gosh, you know, Stephen's birthday is in July, and Maddie's birthday is in early June, and this is on the calendar. And it became like this sort of crazy scheduling game. And she'd started out kind of wanting to have everybody's input. And then finally she wrote all of us and said, and this was, I think, on June 26th, I've chosen the date. It's June 30th. Gave us 4 days. And by that point, all of us who had various other activities had come to understand quite clearly, they were secondary. And in fact, in a way, I was supposed to go to a wedding. You know, it was like, it was a little bit of denial. You can't die because I have to go to a wedding. Well, sorry, Stephen, really not about you. And Julie's best friend often says that to me, Stephen, that's not about you. And Jenny was absolutely right.
Can you talk a bit about fear and kind of to what extent did family members, the patient herself feel fear, and kind of what was that like around different stages in the journey as that kind of turned into more acceptance and wanting it?
It's an interesting question because throughout Julie's illness, I would say in the left hand, I held fear, and in the right hand, I held hope. And I think we all did that. And as time went on, they became dynamic in a way. Initially, our fear was when she had this surgery that she might not survive it. It's a very complicated surgery, you know, and then we hoped that not only would she, but that it would be successful. You know, and as time went on, especially, you know, what we hoped for had to change. You know, we couldn't hope at a certain point that she was going to beat the odds, that she was going to be one of the small percentage that lives longer than 5 years. So then it was, you know, we have to hope that she lives comfortably and she has a good quality of life. And, you know, so the fear was kind of the inverse of that all along. And then when we got, you know, towards the end, Julie had what I would call a good death. Her death itself was relatively pain-free. She was with her loved ones and she transitioned peacefully. So, you know, the fears that I did have about what her death could be did not come to fruition. And our hope that she would have a peaceful passing did. That's how I understand those two.
What was the last day of her life like, both for her and for you?
Well, our whole family was there in Maplewood, as we had been throughout her illness. My brother and his family came down from Connecticut. I came up from North Carolina. She died on a Friday. That Thursday, we were all there. We had dinner. Julie wasn't eating at that point. She was having to prepare, but she was with us. We told stories. You'd never would have known this was the day before. Then we went to bed, and I had started texting with Jay and Julie before we went to sleep. And so I texted from, I was on the guest sofa in the basement. I texted them and told Julie, you know, how much I loved her. She replied back how much she loved her two brothers. My brother chimed in. You know, we had, you know, we really had this beautiful exchange that I've held on to. And she was very funny. She said, you know, I'm going to sleep in tomorrow. Don't come up to my room and wake me up. So, no. So at 6 a.m., though, I hear her. She's in the kitchen. And I'm like, okay, well, that she's not sleeping in. And she's writing letters. It turns out she's finishing up a letter to her girls that she hides among the Christmas ornaments, which we don't discover until Christmas at the end of the year. But Julie had always been in charge of decorating her tree and taking it down, and was very particular about that. And so she left them a 4-page single-spaced letter about how to do it properly. And they discovered that when they opened the ornament box to decorate the tree, you know, in December. So she was very busy. She, I remember once her insurance company opened up, she had them on the line and she said, you know, I really need you to get back to me before noon because I'm doing MAID then. So she'd always been a doer. Robert, I was just amazed. She was in a good frame of mind, but I also think part of that was she knew that the suffering was going to stop. And then she took a lovely walk with my brother, who's a landscaper, through their backyard, through the garden, which he had helped with, and which she just loved that. The hydrangeas were out, the irises, you know, and then it was time and she went upstairs and with her wife and her daughters, she took the medication.
It just sounds so peaceful, so calming, so opposite to what I see in hospitals as patients die. Was that how it was feeling at the time, or was it bizarre in some way or somehow contradictory? What was going through you at that moment, at the very end?
Well, we took a family picture before they went upstairs, and all of us are on the sofa and Julie's in the middle. And, you know, in a way, Julie was, you know, this is a superficial thing. She looked great until, you know, until the end. And, you know, if you look at that picture, most of us are smiling in some, I don't know, smiling in some weird way. And I remember thinking as the picture was being taken, what does my face say? Because my heart is breaking. My mind says this is the right thing. This is the right time. But it was peaceful. It was planned. And you know, and most importantly, this was her choice and she was being able to exercise that. You know, I've seen others die. I saw my parents die, and my father especially had a very, very rough time of it, and painful in every possible way to him and to us. And you know, and so in many ways, her choice of using medical aid in dying was a gift to us. You know, it was a real gift. We understood. We knew how much she loved us, how much we loved her. We had, you know, we really had the opportunity to say, you know, goodbye in the most significant way. You know, one of the reasons that I've, you know, been talking about this, well, there are two reasons. One, Julie really wanted me to talk about medical aid in dying because it became clear to her as she was learning more that so many people don't even know what it is, how it works, and where it's legal. And it's legal in the state of New Jersey as it is in 9 other states in the District of Columbia. But almost none of our close friends knew that. And polls also show that, you know, the great majority of people don't know when it is legal in their state, even though they support the idea. So she kind of charged me with talking about all of this after she died. And so that's been kind of the driving force in me writing about it and talking to you today, because she can't be here to do that.
Can you tell listeners about the process she had to go through in order to be able to make this choice at the end of her life?
So the process is very well defined in New Jersey law and the laws of the other states. There's some variance around a residency requirement. So New Jersey is a state that requires you to be a resident. Vermont, for example, is a state that does not require that anymore. But she had to get medical sign-off from two doctors. She had to say, yes, she understood what was happening twice, orally. You know, she could revoke at any point. She had to then, at another time, put it in writing. So there was a process. Process is meant to safeguard everybody, but to also make sure that it's, you know, a conscious decision, you know, a decision of sound body and sound mind. It can, you know, I think one of the difficulties is that it takes a certain amount of time because there are built-in waiting periods. And for some who don't start as soon as she did, they have to wait out the clock, and there's often a lot of suffering in that time. So some of the original states that already have medical aid in dying are looking at reducing some of the waiting times. Colorado is one of those, you know, and I understand that. I also understand that groups that represent disabled people have been worried about this, and that individuals who may be a burden already to their families because of their disability, they fear that there may be a rush to push them into a decision before it's time. And I'm very empathetic with that. You know, in the research that I did for the Times piece and other pieces, I haven't found any evidence of that happening, but I understand that concern for sure.
What about a view that there could be, I'll say, racial issues related to this process?
Well, you know, it's not racial issues per se, but it is. So Julie's medication cost $900 out of pocket. Another woman who I've written about, Linda Bluestein, lived in Connecticut. Hers cost $750, no insurance. So generally, insurance does not cover this medication or these medications. And so then you have an economic divide. You know, you have to be able to afford it. And then you look at the, you know, sort of, you look further down into how economic divides break out. And, you know, generally there is a race or ethnic differentiation there. So that by and large, you have white folks who are able to afford these medications who are utilizing this option. So there's an inherent difference and less access in a way. And it's basically the same kind of differential you see in access to healthcare based on race. And you know, and some of the research I did also shows that there are different attitudes about death and dying in different communities, and especially in communities of color versus others. So that plays into it too. But you really have a picture of a great majority of white people of means and who are suffering from cancer.
As you know, the type of pain that comes with severe mental illness is a criterion that is allowed in some countries, but not in the United States. Based upon your experience as a family member, do you have a perspective about this?
I'll be honest, I don't have a perspective about that. I think it's a very worthwhile conversation to pursue, for individuals to pursue, for communities and for policymakers to pursue. But I don't have a perspective. I don't know enough. I don't know how it is being proposed, what the criteria would be. You know, I left out earlier, you know, among all the criteria that Julie had to meet, she also first had to have a terminal diagnosis, which meant that they expected her not to live longer than 6 months. That is likely not to be the case with someone with mental illness. So I don't know how those frameworks are being set up at this point.
I believe that Julie was in hospice. You talked a little bit about the added medications that were provided to her for pain. What was your experience of hospice, and what can you recommend to listeners who are contemplating this as part of their end of life journey?
Well, I'm gonna back up a little bit. So both of our parents died in 2017, within a fairly short period of time. And my mother had been ill with lung cancer first. And there was a time when she exhausted the treatments. She was terrified of the word hospice. And I think that, many people, you know, just associate hospice with death, and maybe with, you know, they're all the Grim Reaper, and they're just going to come in and, you know, and pluck you out. So we did sign her up for hospice, and this was a hospice on Long Island, and they didn't wear uniforms, and they didn't have, they didn't have a car that had the name of the hospice on it. So she just thought that they were, you know, it was another set of nurses, and she was very happy with that. About 6 weeks after she died, it was time for my father to have hospice care. Well, the same set of people showed up, and of course he knew exactly who they were. By that point, we all understood a little bit more. And by that, I mean, hospice, I mean, those folks are by and large angels. They have so many ways to reduce pain, increase comfort, you know, at a time that is already stressful. Laying on of hands is kind of miraculous. You know, I can't speak more highly. And the same was true in Julie's case. I mean, she had been there for both of her parents, and she proactively, you know, sought out hospice because she knew that this would give her, or hoped that it would give her more comfort. And, you know, the staff, the people that she had, the social worker, the nurse, were really incredible to her, to Maddie, and to the rest of our family. You know, and I think this kind of goes back to an earlier point that I was making. You know, if we can talk about dying, we can talk about ways to lessen that pain. Let's do that, because there are ways we can help out our loved ones. I want to add in one thing when we're talking about, you know, sort of the experience of what it was like for her to take the medication. You know, I had been reading, and these are mostly by opponents of medical aid in dying, that, you know, a patient or loved one is going to have to like take 100 pills or some huge number of pills. And, you know, you sort of, the way they're talking about it, you kind of imagine they're all horse pills or these oversized vitamins. That's not the case. You know, the patient, you know, gets the medication and it's a powder. All, you know, all those capsules have been emptied out, and you just mix them with a couple of ounces of water or apple juice and you swallow it. This is why I think it's really important for people to understand, well, what is the truth? What actually happens? You know, and then, you know, Julie drank that, and she fell into a sleep within 2 or 3 minutes, and then she really was in that state for several hours while her body shut down. It was peaceful. We were present. We talked to her, because doctors often say the last sense to go is someone's hearing. So I think that's just, we just need to understand more.
When my mother was dying, she died in hospice, but she was actually in a hospital at the time. She had a life-ending type problem. But I remember her asking, I was there, my brother was there, my sister was there, am I in heaven? Because she assumed children were there, that she had to have been in some great destination. And I've heard this from quite a number of people. The individual I wrote about in Uncaring, you know, talked about how he was on a train, and it was a very enjoyable train as he was going to his next destination. It sounds as though your sister had a very similar type end of life experience.
Well, you know, Robert, I heard you talk, I think, about a rabbi earlier. So am I making a correct assumption that you're Jewish?
I am Jewish, and the Rabbi Melanie Aaron was our guest in the previous Fixing Healthcare and End of Life. So listeners know well what she said.
So the reason I bring that up is my family was Jewish, but we were not raised Jewish. We had very atheist parents. But Julie's family, you know, they practiced. But one of the, we joked about this because, you know, one of the conundrums, I guess, is that the Jews don't believe in an afterlife. So we decided, though, that we did. You know, and Julie was, you know, very happy about the notion, you know, whether it was fabricated or not, that she was going to be able to see old friends, see her parents, so on and so forth. You know, I think that's a helpful notion. Obviously, it's above my pay level to know whether any of that's true or not. But it definitely gave us comfort to talk that way.
No one knows what happens after death. And so whatever anyone comes up with is supposition. And as you say, people can have their own view, whether those who don't believe it want to deride it, or whether those who believe it want to insist upon it. That is obviously personal. And you know, the show is about the science of it all, but the human experience is part of that science. What advice do you have for physicians about being better able to talk about death? You talked to a lot of them about end of life, or at least Julie did, and with your parents, I suspect you did directly. So, you know, how can they get better? How can they feel more comfortable? What should they be doing as you, a health expert, a journalist, a loving brother, etc., has concluded at the end of this process?
You know, physicians are in the business of extending life. And my experience has been that it is deeply challenging to them to think of what they're doing in any other way. Julie had the most wonderful oncologist. We all love him at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And he did everything that he could to extend her life, to keep the quality of her life as high as it could be. He did not participate, you know, in the conversations with her about this sort of next choice that she made, except to say that, you know, what I said earlier was that he thought that she would have a painless and fast death. And you know, that was based on his previous experience. And I know that he hoped that would be our experience. But in many ways, Robert, I don't know that physicians are different than the great majority of us who just can't deal with this. I'm laughing. They're people too, doctors, you know, shocking as that sounds. And, you know, I think it's not as much a part of their training and conversations. And so I think there's a lot of room for for physicians to grow when it comes to their knowledge of death and dying, their knowledge of hospice, palliative care, and end of life issues.
What would you recommend to the family members of individuals who have this type of terminal disease? How can they help their loved one to make the best decisions about the rest of their life?
Well, I'll go back to what Julie's best friend, Jenny, said to me. It's not about you, Stephen. It's not about these other family members. Listen to your loved one. Take it upon yourself to learn also. It shouldn't be the person who's ill who has to do all the educating of everyone. That's a lot to do. You know, be open to conversations. You know, and I say this with some amount of experience based on not having done that. You know, so when my mother was dying, I was very uncomfortable talking about her impending death. And I remember she asked me how painful would it be for her to die. And I replied with, "What do you want for dinner tonight, Mom?" I've always been really chagrined by that, but I couldn't answer the question. It's not because I didn't know the answer. It's just I couldn't entertain that question. So I diverted us. And then like 2 weeks later, she asked me a similar question. And then I realized, okay, I needed to move myself along through this door that she had opened to have this conversation. And I did. I'm not going to say it was easy, but I did. And then really that left me feeling much more confident in being able to be present with her fears. And then when Julie really got to that point, I carried that over, and as did our other family members. So we were able to be there. But that is, it is a hard place to meet at. And so it's not about you, and it's about lessening suffering, is the way I would put it in the end.
Obviously, there is still kind of a lot of stigma around this topic. And since her passing, you know, with your advocacy, what kind of pushback have you gotten? And what do you tell to people who maybe are kind of considering the same route, but are worried about the social stigma around it and, you know, maybe how they or their family members will be judged?
I'm known for my bad humor, Jeremy. So I'm going to go into it. And whenever I would say something like I'm going to say, Julie would say to me, "Stephen, you're so bad." And so what I'm going to say is, if you're the patient, no need to worry about it. You're going to be dead. And, you know, I don't say that really lightly, but that's not going to be your problem. Now, there is stigma. And I think that stigma comes out of fear. And I think part of my mission here is, you know, most of us don't know someone who exercised this choice. And so I'm trying to make Julie someone they know, you know, someone who they understand better and why she did this, so that the next time someone might confront this, they can go, okay, she did this. This is how she did that. I can learn from that.
Early in your article, you talk about you and your sister saying you had no more issues that were yet to be discussed or resolved. How did you reach that wonderful place? I think that's almost impossible. What can you tell us about how you reached it and what we all can learn from you and from Julie, from your experience?
Well, I didn't have any, but I was talking to my therapist a week or so before all of this. And he said, you know, why don't you check in with her and make sure she doesn't? And so I did. And she said, no, we're good, which it did not surprise me, because we'd had a very intentional siblinghood, you know, our entire lives. We had a very deep friendship. We were both gay. We came out around the same time. We had our secrets. We fooled our parents. I had had cancer in my 20s. She had attended to me. So we really just had such a solid basis in our friendship, you know. So that, you know, that's how we got there. I understand many relationships and sibling relationships can be fraught, and all kinds of family relationships can be fraught. And I'm not the kind of person who says, you know, tie everything up with a pretty bow and you know, and call it a day. Some relationships are difficult. And, you know, I was never able to do that with my father. You know, we had a very painful and fractured relationship. And I remember you know, after he died, or maybe it was almost as he was dying, I wasn't in a place to say, I love you. I just wasn't. And so instead I said, I wish you peace, Dad. And that was as good as I could do. And this was the point where he was already unresponsive. So relationships are very challenging, and especially family ones. And you know, so when I talk about the strong relationship I have with Julie, I don't want others who are listening to feel, oh, something's not right with me or my relationships in my family. I've had plenty of challenges too, as do others in my family.
Hearing you talk about you and your sister, I can't imagine that there's not at least a moderate-sized void in your day-to-day life. How do you fill it in?
That's a great question. I don't try to fill it in, but I do feel the void. I remember after I had cancer when I was 26, I was terrified of recurrence. I was terrified of a lot of things. And I'll blame this now on being a relatively young person at the time, but I did not deal with those emotions. I put them in Al Gore's lockbox. You know, I just compartmentalized. That did not work out for me. You know, it's hard to keep emotions hidden away like that. And you know, and eventually I did have to deal with them. So I had learned from that experience not to do that with my grief, to put it away and carry on with my life and be active and be busy. So I'm trying to experience them as they come up. Grief comes up randomly. It's shocking to me, it surprises me. But then I try to acknowledge it and say, okay, I feel you. And I also understand this grief is a manifestation of my loss, of my missing you, Julie. And I try to understand it that way and, you know, and move through the day, and then joy will pop up. I didn't think in a way that I would experience joy again, but I remember our whole family was together at Christmas. See, we're that kind of Jew. We celebrated Christmas. It was our first Christmas without Julie, and you know, we were missing her terribly. And on the other hand, we were telling stories about her, and there was a lot of laughter and love. So it's a fine balancing act.
What is your final piece of advice to people who are in the same situation Julie was, and are contemplating making the same decision that she made?
I would say my final piece of advice is, be as informed as you can about as much as you want. It's not my place to tell anybody what to do, but I hope that people know that, you know, in these 10 states and in DC, this is an option. By choosing that option, by getting certified, it does not mean you even have to do it. About 30% of people who are so-called qualified, they don't exercise it in the end, but they still get a great amount of peace by knowing that they have a choice, and they have a choice to end their suffering if they so choose to. So be informed.
Stephen, you ended your article by saying, I also vowed to keep my promise to tell this story, a brother's last act of devotion to a sister he loved beyond all measure. Thank you so much for fulfilling that vow on Fixing Healthcare today.
Thank you, Robert.
As a reminder to listeners, this episode is available on our website, fixinghealthcarepodcast.com, and on all podcast apps, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you like the show, please rate it 5 stars and share it with your friends and family. To submit a question or comment to the host, please visit the contact page on our website or send us a message on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.